Today's podcast is brought to you by Audible. Get a free audiobook download and a 30-day free trial at www.audibletrial.com/AOIS21.
Welcome to It's Not Even Past, a history of the distant present, hosted by Evan Tucker and the production of the AS21 Podcast Network, brought to you by AS21 Audio. This podcast is available on Podomatic, Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Stitcher Radio, TuneIn, and audio.as21.com.
So now we come to the final two movements of Mavlost. Now, after these four movements we've already heard, Smetanov put the piece down for a few years, during which he wrote his famously angst-ridden first string quartet called From My Life, and three operas that are played all the time in Czech-speaking lands, but rarely ever are heard anywhere else. Now, the first four movements of Mavlost can almost be seen as a symphony. It's customary in a lot of performances to take an intermission between the first three movements and the last three, but that strikes me as a horrible break in the momentum. The first four movements clearly belong together, and they're meant to belong together. Even if the last two movements technically belong in the same piece with the first four, they are a very, very different type of music, and it's the work of a composer who's evolved to something very different. And the difference is all the way down at the DNA level. The aim of the final two movements is extremely different from the first four. The first four movements are hymns to the greatness of the land, and the last two are homilies, they're battle cries, they're calls to action and defense. And the first four movements, even Sarka, have a kind of diversionary entertainment character to them, but the last two, nobody will mistake them for anything but grim. Tabor is a portrait of the Hushite warriors of the 15th century. Now, Hushites were proto-Protestants, and that's a relatively rare phenomenon in the modern Czech lands. But for a while, these Czech antecedents to Luther managed to stave off the combined military forces of the Holy Roman Empire and the Catholic Church. But the Taborites didn't just presage Martin Luther. They were, if anything, proto-communists. In 1419, they announced the Millennium of Christ, that all property would be commonly held with no taxes, they showed mercy to those whom they defeated, they forgave heresy, and the Pope called for five separate crusades against them, and the armies of the popes were defeated five separate times. But when they were finally defeated, as of course they had to be, given what they were up against, they were killed to a number between 13,000 and 18,000. Now, it all began with a priestly intellectual named Jan Hus, who was, until Václav Havel, the key figure in Czech history who, like Martin Luther, gained his eminence by denouncing Catholic corruption. When it came time for Luther to do the same 100 years after Hus, Luther deliberately drew lessons from the mistakes that cost Hus his life and plunged the Kingdom of Bohemia into a series of wars they ultimately could not win. Now, in the beginning of Tabor, we hear what at least sounds to me like battle preparation with distant horns in the background and what sounds almost like a battle cry.
Thank you.
And we then hear the Hushite zealot faith portrayed in a hymn tune. This is obviously a bit later in the piece. We'll talk later about what that hymn tune is, but right after we hear this hymn with that final bum 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 ba, bum 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 bum, which is like an admonition to remember the theme, we hear what sounds like a grim battle and the ultimate defeat, which the Hushites must, at least the practical among them, know is inevitable. gets grimmer from there. Now, if you were to play the fifth movement, Tabor, on its own as a concert piece, it probably wouldn't work. It really only gets going after more than 6 minutes of exposition, and it has, as I'm sure you heard, an almost Philip Glass-like obsession with the three Ds that clearly take their cue from the Allegretto in Beethoven's Seventh Symphony. Now, so many conductors, great ones, seem completely at a loss to make this music work. Now, both Karl Ancherl and Charles Mackerras, the first one is a great Czech conductor who has a great affinity for difficult music, and Mackerras is an Australian conductor who conducted everything but studied in Prague and had a particular weakness for Czech music, and they seem to sort of get it, but neither of them can bring themselves to slow down enough for certain passages not to sound really awkward. Now, Lovro von Matačić, a Slovenian conductor who's famous in a lot of different repertoire, comes still much closer, and he has a full measure of the weight and the raucousness and the orchestral sound and a very broad tempo, but he was never a stickler for precision, and he creates this very deep, very unprecise, very spread out, to use a term that every classical music lover will know, very Furtwanglerian, and it's a very German kind of orchestral sound that has no real spring of the dance in it. And it's something very deep, and deep is something, frankly, that this music probably can't be accused of being. Now, Nikolaus Harnoncourt, who we talked about last week, he's one of the world's most imaginative musicians, and he has the imagination to take Smetana's tempo markings at their word, which is shocking, I know, but the tempo markings are, frankly, incredibly slow. Now, nobody conveys the ominous suspense in the introduction as well as Harnoncourt does, but in different performances, Harnoncourt is let down by both the Vienna Philharmonic and the Concertgebouw Orchestra, arguably the world's two greatest orchestras, and neither of them give him the requisite heft and the raucousness that the movement requires, particularly at that broad a tempo. Now, even Václav Talich, the Czech conductor, who learned how to conduct Dvorak from the composer, doesn't really seem to know what to do with Tabor. And Rafael Kubelik, the Czech superstar and probably my favorite conductor in the world, he left 5 recordings of this piece, and he always tried to romanticize it with that enormous heart of his. And there was lots of phrase bending and huge pauses and tempo changes, but by doing that, he would lose the very fragile through line of the piece. The only two conductors who really seem to get it are both sort of specialist maestros in Czech music. You know, they would basically go around the world seemingly conducting nothing but Smetana, Dvorak, Janáček, Josef Silk, Martinů, and whomever else. Now, one performance is the Czech Philharmonic with Jiří Bělohlávek, their recently deceased music director. But especially good, it was Bělohlávek's predecessor, Václav Neumann, but with the Leipzig Gewandhaus Orchestra. These are conductors whom foreign audiences often write out as dull when we hear them in a lot of familiar rep, like the New World Symphony or the Dvorak Cello Concerto. But they have probably conducted every scrap Smetana ever wrote multiple times. And Jakub Hruša, a Czech conductor who's my age, he also pretty much gets it. And he's probably well on his way to conducting all the Smetana in the world, too. Now, the idiom of Smetana is so foreign to most of us because many things about it are counterintuitive. Smetana left metronome markings only for the last 3 movements of the piece, and any music lover who looks at the score and at the metronome markings, particularly for the last 2 movements, will be shocked by how slow he wants many passages to be played compared to most performances and recordings that we hear. There are many, many sparse passages in Smetana, which you think can't carry the weight of a slow tempo, but in fact, they only work at slower tempos. If you try to make Tabor into something speedy, with Liszt-ian bravura, it's going to fall flat. But if you turn directly into the inertia, the orchestra can impose an enormous weight of sound, and it's maybe a Bruckner-like stoicism, and it can be terrifying in the same manner as perhaps a pagan mask is. Now, this is just another example of how Smetana is easily in the pantheon of musical geniuses, but there is so much by him that hardly anybody knows, and because nobody knows it, the idiom becomes still harder to understand once you finally hear it. And like so many composers, you need to hear it enough to have a chance to assimilate it. But there are 2 kinds of musical genius, and just like there are 2 kinds of artistic genius, and I'm going to talk about this by quoting and then letting the quoter quote a quote. Here is what Isaiah Berlin has to say about what Friedrich Schiller has to say about it. Ahem. In his once celebrated essay published in 1795, which he called Über naive und sentimentalische Dichtung, Schiller distinguished between two types of poets: those who are not conscious of any rift between themselves and their milieu or within themselves, and those who are so conscious. For the first, art is a natural form of expression. They see what they see directly and seek to articulate it for its own sake, not for any ulterior purpose, however sublime. Homer, Aeschylus, Shakespeare, even Goethe are poets of this kind. They are not, as poets, self-conscious. They do not, like Virgil or Ariosto, stand aside to contemplate their creations and express their own feelings. They are at peace with themselves, their aim is limited, and they are able, if they have genius, to embody their vision fully. These Schiller calls naive. With them, he contrasts those poets who come after the fall. When man enters the stage of culture and art has laid its hand on him, the primordial sensuous unity is gone. The harmony between sense and thinking, which in the earlier stage was real, now exists only as an ideal. It is not in a man as a fact of his life, but outside him as an ideal to be realized. The unity has been broken. The poet seeks to restore it. He looks for the vanished harmonious world, which some call nature, and builds it from his imagination, and his poetry is his attempt to return to it, to an imagined childhood, and he conveys his sense of the chasm that divides the day-to-day world, which is no longer his home, from the lost paradise, which is conceived only ideally, only in reflection. Hence, this ideal realm is bounded by nothing. It is, in its very essence, indefinable, unattainable, incapable of being embraced by means of any finite medium. No matter how great the poet's capacity for finding, molding, transforming his material. Let me quote Schiller again. Visual art reaches its goal in the finite, that of the imagination, in infinity. And again, the poet is either himself nature or he seeks her. The first of these Schiller calls naive, the second sentimentalisch. The naive artist is happily married to his muse. He takes rules and conventions for granted, uses them freely and harmoniously, and the effect of his art is, in Schiller's words, tranquil, pure, joyous. The sentimental artist is in a turbulent relation to his muse, married to her unhappily. Conventions irk him, and although he may defend them fanatically, he is amfortas, and this is just my note here, but amfortas is the wounded grail knight from the myth of Percival, from the King Arthur legends. He is amfortas and seeks peace, salvation, the healing of his own or his society's secret and patent wounds. He cannot be at rest. His observation is forcibly pushed aside by fancy, his sensibility by ideas. He closes his eyes and ears so that nothing may disturb his self-absorption in his own thoughts. His soul suffers no impression without at once turning to contemplate its own play. In this matter, we never receive the object itself, only what the reflective understanding of the poet made of the object. And even when the poet is himself this object, when he wants to portray his feelings to us, we do not apprehend his feelings directly at first hand, but only their reflection in his soul, what he thought about them as a spectator of himself. End quote. Sorry for its length. Smetana was as much the second type, the sentimentalisch, which does not mean sentimental in the sense that we use it today, as there exists in music. So was Wagner, so was Schumann, so was Mahler, so perhaps even was Beethoven. But so many of their rivals and competitors were naive geniuses. Dvorak, Mendelssohn, Verdi, Liszt, Chopin, Strauss, Mozart, Schubert. To these naive geniuses, composing comes easily, and even if the meaning is closer, it does not mean naive in the sense that we mean it today. It's not that these composers are naive people, it's that their genius was naive. The person who has it is completely ignorant of where it comes from. Music is for them like a stream which they could never stop if they wanted to turn it off. Whatever qualities their music has, the moment they write the music down, so much of it seems to be perfect, like it all comes too easily to them. So let me formulate this slightly differently. The first type, the naive type, is musical geniuses, period. The second type, the sentimental type, is geniuses who chose music and wrote their music with an expressive or perhaps even a didactic purpose in mind. Their great musical gifts are hard won. They take a long time to ferment, and their gifts sometimes dry up before the end of their lives. In some ways, their music can be extremely clumsy, but the great works always manage to do the right thing at the right time. Now, Smetana was clearly not in this formulation, a musical genius, but a genius who chose music. He saw when no one else did, and this was in his letters, that Wagner had exhausted tragic opera, but that comedy was still a mine worth digging. He saw that his particular nation, the Czechs, had need for an opera which spoke to their experiences. And from those two insights, he created The Bartered Bride, an opera that everybody knows, even if you don't think you know it. It's the Dance of the Comedians from The Bartered Bride, which you probably know as the music by which Wile E. Coyote chases Roadrunner. Now, this semi-didactic way of writing was how Smetana got inspiration. He seemed to say, what do my people need? And what they seemed to need, above all else, was music that spoke to their experience. Now, almost all of his mature piano music is dance music. His mature songs can just about all be sung by amateurs. His mature operas are all either from Czech mythology or Czech history or realistic dramas about Czech people. I don't know if that is the reason, but except for The Moldau and The Bartered Bride, Smetana doesn't really cross borders. Even Mavlast, which has a number of great conductors who champion it, gets much more lip service as a masterpiece than it ever gets performances. Now, the average city with a competent C-list orchestra might play it every 20 years when some veteran Czech conductor comes into town. Every major musical country has their secret geniuses who don't seem to translate. Even Germany has Max Reger and Karl Maria von Weber, while Austria has the Franzes Schmidt and Schrecker. I have yet to hear a snatch of a work by Franz Schmidt and think to myself that this guy has a memorable thought. But that's the nature of so much art. Not everything's going to speak to everyone. Abroad from here, people recognize the greatness of Gershwin and Ives all the time, and they even play Barber's Adagio ad nauseum, even if they don't play anything else by Barber. But believe it or not, the genius of Aaron Copland still seems to be our little secret. Everybody else seems to just find it a kitschy picture postcard soundtrack. And yet, like Copland, there is something about the incredible dignity and longing in this music that at least I find impossible to stop listening to. But like Copland, it's precisely the power of this music which is dangerous. Just as Copland, the gay Jewish communist, was co-opted by Ronald Reagan's 1984 campaign for his Morning in America ads, Smetana, the great Czech nationalist, was co-opted by the Czech communists. And this is the moment when we have to tell the story of Zdeněk Nejedlý, the sinister Czech version of Forrest Gump. Now, Nejedlý was born in Litomyšl, which is the, I don't know exactly how to pronounce it, but which is the hometown of Bedřich Smetana. He went to Charles University in Prague, where he studied music and philosophy, the latter with Tomáš Masaryk, the first president of a democratic Czechoslovakia. Now, while he was of a student age, Nejedlý asked Dvořák for his daughter's hand in marriage, and Dvořák refused him. This may not be the reason for Nejedlý's lifelong effort to promote Smetana's importance at the expense of Dvořák's, but I doubt it's unrelated. Now, Nejedlý was a university graduate, and he hated most of the musicians taught at the Prague Conservatory, which he associated with Dvořák, with Germanization, with conservatism, probably with stupidity, and with the music just being music rather than a didactic tool for social responsibility. Now, as a music journalist, Nejedlý was so anti-conservatory musicians that he was banned from writing for Czech newspapers. So then he began a music journal called Smetana, which he ran for 16 years. And it wasn't without its good causes, which included the music of Mahler and Alban Berg's great opera, Wozzeck. But the first 4 years of the journal seemed largely devoted to attacking the legacy of the recently deceased Dvořák and every scrap of music Dvořák wrote. When musicians rose in defense of Dvořák with a petition of support, Nejedlý took note and sought to end the careers of the musicians who sided with Dvořák in a hail of vitriol, which included a number of great and still undervalued Czech composers, one of whom was Dvořák's son-in-law, Josef Suk, whom Dvořák obviously approved of in a manner he didn't of the man who would later seek to trash his legacy, and another of whom was Leoš Janáček, whom in 2018, it's at least arguable that he seems a greater composer than either Smetana or Dvořák. So like so many ideologues from small nations, Naegele was both a nationalist and a communist. Naegele, obviously no stranger to controversy, became one of the Communist Party's most effective spokesmen once the party was legalized in the early 20s. Now, for 20 years, he largely devoted himself to political activism. He wanted to write three grand multi-volume biographies about the three great men with whom he was associated, Smetana, Masaryk, and Lenin. He barely even scratched the surface of the Smetana biography and didn't write a page of either the Masaryk or the Lenin. But during World War II, he fled to the Soviet Union, and so eminent a political figure was he, considered by the time of his return, that after the war's end, Eduard Beneš, the post-war leader of the Democratic Czechoslovakia, appointed him Minister of Education, Arts, and Sciences, and in 1946, he was even appointed Minister of Social Security. When Stalin created the Iron Curtain in the late 40s, it was time for show trials, and few people could possibly have been in a better position to settle his scores than Zdeněk Nejedlý. Nejedlý's vitriolic public criticisms of Janáček turned many old friends and allies against him. One old friend in particular, Josef Hutter, whose sole crime was in not shunning another friend who criticized Nejedlý, was given a show trial, at the end of which he was sentenced to 39 years in prison. When, in 1949, Nejedlý had the chance to reinstate Václav Talík, remember him, as the director of the Czech Philharmonic, he declined and made the career of Czech music's primary ambassador the victim of two authoritarian regimes. While Talík was forced to spend his final quarter century as a journeyman conductor, usually for second-rate orchestras, while the orchestra he built, the Czech Philharmonic, moved from glory to glory. But Nejedlý had still higher ambitions than dictating the future of the Czech Philharmonic. While at a meeting at which Stalin berated his Czech lapdog, Klement Gottwald, Stalin is reported to have said, "I could have anyone do your job," and he then gestured to Nejedlý, "Even Nejedlý could do it." From that moment on, Nejedlý wanted nothing more than to be dictator of his country, and until the end of his life apparently did everything in his power to earn the good graces of his party's Russian masters. He was thought of by the Czech party elite as a contemptible old man and a joke. The university students, required to read Nejedlý's book, The Communists, Inheritors of the Grand Progressive Tradition of the Czech Nation, doesn't that just sound scintillating, as part of the Marxist curriculum. They thought of him as just another faceless Marxist apparatchik, and most of them probably had no idea that he was even a musician. Now, the musical legacy of Zdeněk Nejedlý was the requirement that Czech students listen to Smetana ad nauseum. They were bused to sit in concert halls, regularly listen to recordings. The musicians among them had to learn to play Smetana. Nothing kills love of music like being conscripted to love it. And nothing killed Smetana's reputation faster than his greatest champion. Nothing can kill the reputation of a naive musical genius. Their work will always speak for itself, regardless of the context. But a sentimental artistic genius needs the right environment for his work to speak properly. And if Smetana could not even speak in the Czech lands properly, what hope had he elsewhere? And yet, Smetana remains. I have a close musical friend who is a Slovak, and he rebelled against the diet of Smetana and Dvořák he was fed as a kid in communist Czechoslovakia, and he found Sex Pistols, Parliament Funkadelic, Taraf da Hajduks, and Fanfare Czocharlia. And yet, somehow, in spite of Smetana and Dvořák getting drummed into him as a kid, there is still room for them today. It's the music his parents and grandparents tuned to every holiday when it was on television and the radio. In many ways, it's still the music of communal life, and it's present for new generations to appreciate, if they so choose. Now, communal life, to make a sort of awkward segue, is exactly what's at stake in Blahnik, the last movement. Now, Blahnik is the Czech mountain in which an army of Hushite knights led by Saint Wenceslas is said to sleep. And they will only awaken at the Czech Republic's darkest hour to lead the ultimate battle for its liberation. Now, in a world where the absolute of godly belief began to vanish, nationalism of this period was a bit like religion 2.0 and filled the need for the religious consolation which tells us that one day life will be worth all of our struggles. Now, internationalism is, let's face it, in all probability, religion 3.0. But I digress. Blahnik begins with the exact same kind of hammering motif that is omnipresent through all of Tabor. we then seem to hear is the peaceful life on the mountain that sort of lies awaiting the moment of emergence, and we even hear a shepherd's hymn in the oboe. A shepherd's hymn in the Double Reeds is another musical image that has a great romantic pedigree. It stretches from Rossini's William Tell to Berlioz's Symphonie Fantastique to Wagner's Tristan. It's even in the same root tonality of F as both Berlioz and Wagner. But this Valhalla of Czech heroes awakens and cinematically rides to the scene of the battle. on that that motif shows up in Bruckner 8 a decade later. But that motif is the pin on which Smetana hangs the whole design of both these movements. And getting there is a little troublesome. I've never really been convinced by all that horse galloping we just heard. Musically, it's a little thin, don't you think? It's just a bunch of triplets, but in an explosive performance like the one we're hearing now of Raphael Kubelik and the Czech Philharmonic, the fireworks and the playing will make it worthwhile. But what's important here is the motif, which is from the Hushite hymn that we have been talking about for this whole broadcast. And now we will say what it is. The hymn is, "Ye who are warriors of God." The first three lines are, "Ye who are God's warriors and of his law, pray to God for help and have faith in him, that always with him you will be victorious." Now, it's played first by the horn in this movement and then taken up by what seems to be a village band. But it's then played twice through towards the end, more massively each time, like a parade that draws ever closer and draws more people into following it. We never really hear the victorious battle in Blahnik. I suppose that was the point of Tabor. We only hear the victory hymn that follows the battle. We've heard something like the story of Václav Talich in that famous concert in 1939. We won't hear any of the legendary concert that Karel Ančeril, the other legendary director of the Czech Philharmonic, installed by Nejedli over the grave opposition of the orchestra, gave not with the Czech Philharmonic, but with the Boston Symphony in Tanglewood after defecting to Canada after the Prague Spring of 1968. It's a great performance in which you clearly hear the thunderstorm that enveloped the outdoor surroundings. And after it was done, Ančeril apparently broke down in tears and said that he felt like nothing at all without his familiar surroundings and the people he loved. But we have heard and will hear more of Raphael Kubelik, probably the most legendary Czech performing musician of all, the son of Jan Kubelik, one of the world's most famous violinists in the early 20th century. As I said earlier, Kubelik is my favorite conductor, and one of his most famous utterances is that only conscience can produce great art. So after Václav Talich was fired by the Nazis around 1942, Kubelik, not yet 30, was made the director of the Czech Philharmonic. He lasted for 6 years, and when the communists came to power, he almost immediately defected to the West. When asked about it, he said that I had lived through one form of bestial tyranny, and as a matter of principle, I was not going to live through another. Unfortunately, he neglected to tell his wife about his plans until they were on the plane. The conscience of artists must, sadly, always be graded on a bit of a curve. The communists convicted the couple in absentia of taking illicit leave, but a few years later the communists publicly offered him carte blanche to return to Czechoslovakia. Any orchestra, any project, any composer. Kubelik responded with an op-ed that was reprinted through the world, in which he said that he would only return when all artists, all émigrés, all people of Czechoslovakia were allowed the same freedom. 15 years later, when the Prague Spring erupted, Czech freedom seemed imminent, and freedom finally seemed possible in any communist country at all, as it did during the Prague Spring. And so when that happened, the communists offered him carte blanche again, and he refused again, no doubt having the suspicion that it wouldn't last. If that was his suspicion, he was entirely right. In 1968, the Soviet tanks moved in. Many of the preeminent Czech artists were thrown in jail or forced into exile or banned from having anything more than a menial job. Czechoslovakia again became just as repressive as every other Soviet satellite state. So Kubelik retired in 1985 because of arthritis, but when the Berlin Wall fell and the writer Václav Havel was finally released from prison to become the first Czech president of the liberal republic that still exists today, Kubelik came out of retirement to perform his calling card, Ma Vlast, in the Czech Republic again with the Czech Philharmonic. Now, true to the classical recording glut of the late century, Kubelik had already recorded Ma Vlast in Chicago, Vienna, Boston, and Munich. Unlike so many artists, all of his recordings are different and show that an artist is evolving and learning new things, but the meeting with the Czech Philharmonic is the most legendary performance of all performances of Ma Vlast. Both Kubelik and Talich, in their studio recordings, rarely milked the climax at the end of Blahnik. But in both these legendary concerts, they slow down for the final statement of the Visehrad motif, which is unmistakable, you'll hear it in a minute, and Smetana suddenly attains Beethovenian or Wagnerian or Mahlerian proportions, and the end sounds uncannily like the end of either Mahler's Third or his Fifth Symphony. I don't know if it's what Smetana wanted. When you look at the score, you realize there isn't a single conductor who conducts the climax according to Smetana's instructions. But spiritually, this concert symbolized everything Smetana wanted. It was a healing and an emergence of a new Czech nation. It was a coming together of a community and a return home. It's a document of the first flush of the Czech people as a free and individual nation. Talik's performance was right at the beginning of the Czech long 20th century darkness. Ancel's famous performance was roughly at its midpoint, and Kubelik's famous performance is right at its end. All three stand for more than music. They stand for what music means. Now, like everywhere that was once the Soviet sphere, the Czech Republic is again threatened by the specter of the far right and Putinism. But so far, it still stood as a liberal democracy, unsubjugated by any other country for a quarter century, which is longer than an independent Czech nation has ever existed since the Middle Ages. And when Raphael Kubelik conducts the climax, we hear that Visehrad moment, that harmonic homecoming that goes from a sixth to a third to the tonic, admittedly with a few permutations. And we hear the nostalgia, the longing for home. Ma Vlast means literally my home. And at this moment, it seemed for many people that home was finally achieved.
Much of what happened, what is discovered now, will of course be secret. We will not be given the full answer.
This has been It's Not Even Past, a history of the distant present, hosted by Evan Tucker. This has been a production of the AS21 Podcast Network and brought to you by AS21 Audio. Find this and other episodes on Podomatic, Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Stitcher Radio, TuneIn, and our home on the web, audio.as21.com. Find us on Facebook at facebook.com/itsnoteven past. That's it for this episode, but we'll be back, because the past isn't dead, it's not even past.
Copyright 2018, AS21 Media, LLC. All rights reserved. AS21 Media. What do you want your story to be?